Affect World Affairs. Your host, Research Specialist Mae Brussel.
Oh, hello again. It's Monday at KLRB and time for Dialogue Conspiracy. I've brought so much material in this week, I don't know where to start. The news is just coming in so rapidly. It was 1 week without the committee, Senate committee meeting. I thought I'd get a lot of writing done this week without being glued to the television, but the news was breaking so fast it's hard to cross-file and assimilate the information that's coming out. There was an interesting article about Katherine Graham in the San Francisco Chronicle this week. She's the woman who publishes the Washington Post, and her husband passed away a few years ago, 1963. I have a question mark about his death in the article I'm doing called Murderville, wondering if her husband was murdered. The chain of command of people that he knew is very close to the entire Watergate group, and I wonder sometimes about how Mr. Graham died, and I have a letter to Katherine Graham. I don't know if she'll answer it or not on some questions about his supposed suicide, because there's been a lot of suicides that I wonder now with the chain of command, how they link together. And she's been described as one of the most powerful women in America because of the exposure of the Watergate and keeping the story alive through the election year where everybody wanted to forget it and bring out the evidence. Her writers have been so powerful in bringing out new evidence every day about the Watergate case. And she had a quotation which was very nice in the paper when they asked her about using the power of the newspaper, because it is a powerful media, and they said that she had a lot of power with this paper. And what she said was, "I also have another theory about power. If power is there to be used, it is used whether you abdicate it or whether you use it. You have to remember that you can do as much damage by abdicating it as by using it in the wisest way you know, and that is what I try to do." I think that's a nice way of saying that when you abdicate and don't use the power of your intelligence or your fountain pen to write to public officials or your telephone to pick up certain radio or talk shows or the power of the ballot to vote to affect certain changes in your life, you are abdicating that power. That happened at the last election where people thought they were really being sophisticated and staying away from Richard Nixon. They wouldn't vote for either candidate, McGovern or Nixon, and the appointments that Nixon made afterwards were so terrible that people abdicated the power and let him make a lot of decisions now that are still every day coming down that are very bad. In the course of writing the article Murderville, which I'm winding up now, I found two natural deaths in the news this week. I have a new file called Natural Deaths because I'm suspicious of everything that's coming along. Betty Grable and Joey Brown passed away. They were not conspiracies, I have to tell you. They were not conspiracies. Betty Grable had what we call the old-fashioned cancer, the kind that lingers for 1 or 2 years, as against the Jack Ruby cancer, the last 3 weeks in a Dallas jail. And Joey Brown died, and it was very interesting. I noticed, you know, that people that are a friend of Moriarty or Ronald Reagan or President Nixon die in old age to be 80 or 90, and he's one of them. So I have a new file in my espionage work. It's called Natural Deaths. And while I read the newspaper, I was so glad there were two columns I didn't have to cut out for that file this week. Something good from the Watergate, which before we get to the bad, there's a lot of good and bad. I'm jumping between depression and joy. You know, the news goes up and down. But the U.S. News had an article just this week that Attorney General Elliot Richardson said that the Justice Department is no longer in give top priority to tough law and order action. He said the emphasis now is going to deal with social problems. I can hardly say this without laughing. Social problems of criminal justice with crime prevention and rehabilitation. And they're going to take an interest in the problem of the consumer and the enforcement of anti-pollution and anti-monopoly laws. It's hard to say that with a straight face because the former attorney general, while he was the attorney general, was in conversations down at Key Biscayne and elsewhere making conspiracy plans for the United States for overthrowing the electoral process. The assistant attorney general, Robert Mardian, is going to be indicted for many charges in the Watergate affair for passing money along to the men that were already arrested, bribery, and for destruction of evidence. And Patrick Gray III, the acting head of the FBI, was destroying evidence right and left and was an agent of the National Security Council and not actually belonging to the Federal Bureau of Investigations, and Mr. Silbert, one of the prosecutors in the federal case, is going to be indicted. I read probably for a conspiracy charge for asking the wrong questions and not asking the right people. Those law and order men are on their way out for good. We'll watch Mr. Mitchell perjure himself probably tomorrow. If you have a good ear, you'll pick up a few of those going back and forth. And then that'll add to his Vesco perjury charge. And then when Watergate West moves out here, we'll have Mr. Evel Younger, our Attorney General Wes Graff, formerly of the FBI, and Mr. Reinecke, who wants to be the governor, and Chief of Police Davis in L.A., and a few other law enforcement agents hiding criminal conspiracies, Peter Chang in Santa Cruz and Peter Pitches in Los Angeles. Those conspiracies will roll along, and researchers have a lot of information coming out on affairs that they've been into, but the law and order motto is gone. I hope it's gone for good. And speaking of law and order, the feds are after me. They've done a lot. I think I've paid my dues to them in a lot of ways, and those of you who know me know what I speak about. But this week they were down, the FBI was down in Los Angeles. Incidentally, I wasn't on the enemy list. I'm not that important yet, but they did go into our tax records this last year to see how Mr. Brussel supports me and how much money he gives me, and they gave him a hassle. The Bureau of Internal Revenue went through the tax things to make sure everything was, that I wasn't hiding the $1 million I made from research. I guess that's what they wanted to find out. But now they're into more serious matters, and the Federal Bureau of Investigation went to see my ex-husband in Beverly Hills because they had word or information that I was harboring Stephen Bingham, the man who gave George Jackson, supposedly gave the cover story the gun that created the motive for the San Quentin shootout. I've talked about that case coming up on my radio program several times, and it will be going to court soon. It's been 2 years since George Jackson was killed. I think if I just shared the letter I wrote to the FBI here in Monterey with you on the air, it's self-explanatory, and a lot of people can appreciate, you know, what was happening. Dear Mr. Connolly, that's the FBI man in Monterey, this letter is to confirm our conversation on the telephone this morning and make sure there's no confusion on the matter. My former husband, Mr. A.W. Brussel, related to me his visit at his store by FBI agents in Beverly Hills, California, the week of July 1st to 3rd. The impression of the FBI was that I could be harboring Stephen Bingham on my property located in Vancouver Island, British Columbia. Bingham is supposedly sought by law enforcement agents. I put supposedly because he's really their agent. In the USA regarding the San Quentin killing of George Jackson, several guards and inmates. The only information I have about Bingham has been regarding research in the San Quentin murders. Last year, I attended the trial of Hugo Pinnell in Salinas on a charge of killing a guard at Soledad. I did not know Mr. Pinnell at the time. The trial was conducted in such a rigged manner, obviously framing Mr. Pinnell, that I became interested in his case and subsequently received the transcript to study it for the purpose of giving him a fair day in court someday. Hugo Pinnell was also located at San Quentin for the purpose of medical testing in the Bay Area at the time George Jackson's murder. He is a defendant of the San Quentin Six, one of them. I have followed his case and become his friend through letters we have never met. In the course of research, I met Louis Tackwood, agent provocateur who left Los Angeles in the fall of 71, Los Angeles Police Department. Tackwood held a press conference at which time he spoke about the espionage squad located inside the White House, the links from the FBI to California, up and down the coast of California. That group has been verified with the Watergate arrest, and all that Tackwood stated is in fact true, no matter how you attempt to discredit him. The FBI agent in Los Angeles had tried to discredit Tackwood in front of Mr. Russell. Louis Tackwood also made allegations at the time that the San Quentin shootout was known by the Los Angeles Police Department, that they had foreknowledge and contacts with Stephen Bingham and other agents of the police department, and it was my direct impression that Stephen Bingham could be an agent provocateur who was not an actual friend of George Jackson in any way but provided the cover story for the killing and the fake escape attempt, and this was a classical case of a Nazi Germany prison killing before they took over large numbers later in the concentration camps. Would I keep Stephen Bingham on my property? Hardly. I would like to find Stephen Bingham. I would like the San Quentin Six to have their day in court and have justice served. but I am aware of your dirty tricks department, and I want it clear in writing that I don't want Stephen Bingham found dead at some date or his body or his belongings found on my property. I don't want a case built up in any way that I harbored a criminal. I know many of these conspiracy cases and how they are built and the painful, expensive hassle that is created. It is my personal opinion that racism and hatred run so deep in the fiber of our society that those assigned to protect the law from the president through his Justice Department, the FBI, and the CIA and other agencies are doing this country a great disservice. The best thing Americans can do to help less fortunate than ourselves is to seek justice for those individuals being selected as criminals who, in truth, are innocent men provoked once inside the Department of Corrections to commit violence and frustrations. I don't want any of your conspiracies created against me while I proceed to help my friends find true justice. Sincerely, Mae Bressel. I said that because I did write a letter to Hugo Pinnell, a registered letter which he said was not opened by the prison officials but was open, mentioning that I was trying to locate Bingham as part of the defense. But when you write to a man in prison, and he tells you the truth has to come out, I'm innocent. And if you want to assist him and help him with that defense, you become an enemy of the state. That prison is meant to keep those men in there, and they kill anybody who proves innocence to their cause. And that is the condition of the United States of America. Dialogue conspiracy will go on to Watergate, some of it. There's one other matter. A woman named Reba Mason was very close to prisoners in San Francisco. She worked with him. She went in and out on Sunday. She was the only person to a lot of these prisoners there. Any outside contact, she was family for them and was helped get lawyers and follow their cases. And she meant a lot to several men that I know that are cut off from the world in terms of a future of getting out, having served their time and were framed. And Reba did a fantastic job. And I got a letter from one of the men that I met through Hugo Pinnell at San Quentin, and he wrote to me about a week and a half ago that Reba Mason was dead. And I felt terrible. I'd corresponded with her and telephoned with her regard to things that were happening with the prisoners. And I got a letter from this one prisoner, and I thought that his whole world would cave in, and he had no idea that she was sick or had any problems. So I wrote to her sister, who lives down in Fairfax, California. I wrote to Reba Mason's sister on the nature of her illness, and she wrote to me, I got a letter back dated July 6th, and among other things, she said Reba's illness was not a long one. It was very frustrating her to no end. She thought it started with a pneumonia. She went into the hospital. She was there 2 weeks. Prior to that, she had good health for a number of years. They didn't know how to accept her death, but she was buried. And then I got a letter from this prisoner because I knew he'd feel badly, and I didn't want to be suspicious as I collect information for Murderville or for what's really happening in this country, and I want to rule out my paranoia, so I like to check the documentation. And I got a letter from this prisoner dated July the 5th on the nature of Reba's illness, and he said she was writing him a letter at the time that she got sick. She was doing well, and there was an unfinished letter that the sister sent him saying, "Pneumonia is a bitch, a righteous knockout, but I'm getting better. I don't understand how it all came about." And Qatari, this prisoner, wrote to me. He said, "I used to make an issue of it because her letter that was sent on to him unsigned, she didn't understand how it came about. She got sick, and 2 weeks later, she was dead." And he wrote to me, and this is what he said, "I started to make an issue of it, but I would be hard bit to convince others of foul play, even though I feel there was some. I just commit it to memory until the day I play my design upon the world. There is no sorrow, no pain, no tears. Death is an integral part of life. I was a little depressed when I first learned of her death, but it only led to some profound tripping. After running all aspects of our relationship through my mind, that was it. My energy must be directed towards the living, and the past is my motivation." This is a man who's writing poetry and books up at San Quentin, and I think he said it beautifully. The past of my work, my research into the political assassinations in this country and the multiple killings is my motivation for my work today. I think about the murders and then I go forward. Speaking of murders, I had a conversation today with Sherman Skolnick in Chicago. He's sending out some more information about plane crash 553. I called him and was able to provide him with information today that he didn't have yet regarding that airplane crash. But he said, May, the name of Watergate is murder. And I said, okay, Sherman, in 3 weeks, Murderville will be out. The article is 3 or 4 weeks. I'll have it finished down 3 weeks. The name of Watergate is Murderville. Murder, he said to me. You won't believe what's happening in the Middle West and in the East. And there's so many people dying and being put into prison. His two main investigators are going back into the federal penitentiary with trumped-up charges, and they're getting harassed from all ends. What I called him about was that Sherman Skolnick revealed that there was $40,000 that Mrs. Hunt had on the airplane crash. The government and the media admits to $10,000 that came from Bernard Barker's bank. And she had $2 million in notes and traveler's checks and other money, which has not, for the most part, except in the law file or case, has been recognized. And I did a show, I don't know how many weeks back, on that plane crash that Mrs. Hunt was on, the sabotaging the plane, and mentioned that that Sherman Skolnick said the money came from El Paso Gas. It had something to do with John Mitchell and money from El Paso Gas. Well, the Washington Post had an article, a long article this week, almost a full page, and it goes into that complicated money, that Mexican money transaction. You know, that's one of the big thorns in the side of the White House, the minute the men were arrested, was getting the CIA and the FBI and the White House staff to see what they could do to stop the investigation of the Mexican money. And the Mexican money is a conduit of funds. We've used Mexico interchangeably with all of our political assassinations and espionage operations for 27 years. And that money would go into the funding of political assassinations and a lot of other trips. But in the current 72 affair, it turns out there's a long article. It has to do with John Conley's law firm. It has to do with Brown and Root. These names are familiar with the past political assassination. It has to do with the El Paso Natural Gas and Petroleum Corporation that just got the contract for sending $10 billion natural gas from Siberia to Mexico. And the Texas firm of Mr. Allen that did the fundraising for the Southwest, for Richard Nixon's election, sent a parcel of money from Mexico, that $114,000 that went to the committee to reelect the president and down to Bernard Barker. And then they had a bag of $700,000 cash of other money. And that money is going to tie in, wouldn't you know, to the wheat deal in Russia and the El Paso gas deal. So that the money all came in two bags. Some Barker's bank and some want right to Marie stand safe. And that's where the El Paso gas money came from. It went from the Southwest deal that John Mitchell and Robert Mardian and John Conley were cooking up. And 40,000 of that was in Bernard Barker's account in Miami Beach was with Mrs. Hunt when her plane went down. So the El Paso gas money that John Mitchell was supposed to be interested in tied in with the fundraising that comes when you want to put pressure on a certain people, such as you will get the contract for the Siberian gas if you donate so much to our election reelection fund. See, they had to raise a lot of money before the close-off date by April the 7th, and the suitcase of money that was coming from the Gulf Resources and Chemical Company that Robert Allen sent in, the Houston Mexican money included the El Paso gas deal, the $10 billion deal from Russia to the United States. So I called Skolnick and we talked about that airplane crash and what's going on in Chicago with regards to new evidence of a conspiracy and the sabotaging the plane. Well, I thought this would be a quiet week. As I say, the hearings were off and the news just, it just kept pouring down. There was the president's home is going to be investigated, the funding for his home at San Clemente, and the one in Florida. Mr. Cox has an investigation going on that. The Ellsberg inquiry is opening up a new area, which is very important. It's as important as the Watergate, as far as I'm concerned. And I got a letter. I got the copy of a lawsuit that was filed by Elmer Davis. This is a beauty. It has to do with the Ellsberg case because you remember a man was told to say he was guilty by the Los Angeles Police Department, Elmer Davis, of going into Dr. Fielding's office while he was still at Folsom Prison, which shows that the Beverly Hills Police Department had to be in collusion with the CIA to close the case so that Hunt and Liddy and all the Cubans that flew out wouldn't be involved. So Mr. Elmer Davis has filed a lawsuit for $1 million, a civil complaint, and there was a press conference in Los Angeles, and I have a copy of a suit. And this suit names President Nixon, Agil Crow, and agents of the Beverly Hills Police Department. And I got a letter, a news release from San Francisco from KPFK. It said, enclosed is a civil complaint for $1 million in damages filed by Elmer Davis, a man currently in the California State Prison at Folsom, stemming from the break-in of the office of the Ellsberg files. Now, Mr. Davis is that 45-year-old black legal worker who was charged September the 3rd, 1971 with the break-in of the office while he was incarcerated in jail. So there's a $1 million lawsuit that was placed this week against Richard Nixon, Agil Crow, and the important thing about the lawsuit is that this is the second time in a, this is the first legal suit to back up my research of the links to Washington, California. Up in San Francisco, Mayor Alioto is doing investigative work on John Mitchell and Mitchell's lawyers and Ehrlichman and the White House group because they used the Los Angeles Police Department, the Criminal Conspiracy Section, the FBI, Washington agencies and California agencies. He has not filed a suit back, Alioto. He's named them. This is the first suit that names the link of the Watergate espionage group to the California law enforcement. You're going to see this coming out in California for the next 20 years. But this is the first suit, and it's done by a man in Folsom, and I think that's far out. Because this is the way these individual cases are going to open up the situation faster than anything that's moving along. Now, two mafia figures are being investigated for being released, one from Florida and one from New Jersey. And the Florida case involves Mr. Charles Colson again. He sort of gets the Academy Award here. He's in every act, piece of the action. Charles Colson, he beats them all, but they figured out in Florida, Mr. Smathers and Rebozo, they called the White House. They could get the Jewish vote in Dade County if they let a member of the mafia out of jail. They did it for Christmas. They should have done it for Yom Kippur. But they were going to get the Jewish vote that way. Evidently, there's a big Jewish vote among the mafia, Lansky, and that crowd down in Miami. The Kosher Nostra, they call it, over in Israel, and it stems from Miami. And then in New Jersey, they flew the coop for another mafia figure, and that links in with Spiro Agnew and Frank Sinatra. I'm having a little trouble at home with no help. I need some people, if you want to call and volunteer, to help me cross-file and copy articles, because while I put them under certain subjects like mafia release for votes, you know, like how many things do you go through for votes, you know, like tax, people are getting off being investigated by the Justice Department in exchange for votes, so they're given money in exchange, you know, for a lot of votes. This group down in Houston, they give them the money, and then their investigations at the Justice Department are called off, or they're decided in their favor, or they're springing them from jail. There's all kinds of, or you get profits from the wheat deal and the gas deal. Well, the mafia people were sprung open. The little dinner guest list was disclosed this week at the White House, and that let off another can of worms because that delayed evidence of those 200 contributors, which Richard Nixon's secretary had in her desk, was about 200 corporations, and not one of them is supposed to give to the campaigns. So all these huge corporations, I don't think there's going to be enough lawyers left in this country to cover these suits that are coming out. But one of those corporations turned out to be American Airlines, and then that opened up another nest of worms for Herbert Kalmbach. And a whole list of problems are connected with the American Airlines investigation and possible lawsuits. And they've asked other corporations to come clean now, and they'll get less time in jail or less fines because they must know there's a whole bunch of them. They've put an all-out warning, you know, if you get under the line, like the April 7th line, I guess this is July by, you know, September. If you get under the September line, you'll get a light prosecution. They must have some kind of a deal, you know, working on that. Well, Senator Gurney said he wants the White House to produce their logs. I got a call from New York this morning. Somebody's writing a story for the New York Times. And this fellow's called me a couple of times, and he, he wanted to know what I made of that. You know, he thought that was so fantastic. The Nixon's man wants the White House logs. So as long as it was his time that he was paying for the long-distance call and it wasn't my time, I told him how the government handles evidence, you know, and it was only my time because I should be writing it on paper and not just talking on the phone. But I said, what's so important about Gurney telling the White House to turn over some papers that John Dean had? They've only had a year and a month to clean them out, and we know what they did in 24 hours. So what's so gracious about them turning it over? And I ran down the ways the government handles the evidence. In my research in the John Kennedy assassination, and then in the Robert Kennedy or the Martin Luther King, and then you go into the Manson case and the Ted Kennedy and all political conspiracies, the evidence, the hard evidence that would convict people, what you call evidence, is handled in about six ways. There's more, but I call it six ways. Number one is the classic, they just destroy it. Like in the Watergate, I refer to those because it's easier for people to relate to that. It's happening now. Howard Hunt's desk, in 24 hours, a van came and took everything away, and that was burned in an incinerator, and his files, his working files, his desk was cleaned out by Mr. Haldeman and Dean, and the suggestion was they drop it in the river, put it under the water. Patrick Gray took home stuff to his place, which he burned, and which he said in his clandestine, you know, operation way, I didn't read it, I just burned it. And Sally Harmon, he showed them how to use the offices over at Creep to shred everything they had over there. And Marie Stans tells you about his safe and his papers that were burned. And Herbert Kalmbach was lighting little matches at hotels with little lists of paper, burning those, you know, at his list. So it goes back to the John Kennedy assassination, the lamppost and the car interior and the clothing that John Connally wore, John Kennedy. These things are all destroyed for investigative purposes. And that's one way to handle evidence. And then some evidence is locked up. And there was a real goodie that came out this week. A Common Cause had asked Marie Stans for information of who donated money between March and April. Those are the key dates because that has to do with the Miami Convention, the plans to kill Richard Nixon, and the real military junta. The money they raised that last month was the most secretive and the most important. But any connections to it, Marie Stans said he'd turn them over. He was asked a year ago, and he said, by November, I'll turn them over. And Common Cause said, we'll cite you for contempt of court if you don't do it by April the 6th. So on April the 6th, Marie Stans called a van and had 160 four-drawer cabinets taken to the National Archives. They hide behind. He didn't destroy it then because they knew it existed, but it's in the National Archives. That little goodie came out this week. The contempt charge hasn't been made, but they substituted a list which showed up in this Woods desk at the White House that opened up the other problems. There's evidence delayed when Marie Stans was on the stand and they asked him for a list of donors. He said, I don't have one, but I can reconstruct it for you. You know, well, this is what's happening in the White House, I'm sure, with Dean's papers. They can reconstruct anything they want. There's evidence which is altered. They hold it a while and change it, and then they never fingerprint it to see if the original person touched it. And there's evidence they can't find, which may come up later, altered or missing or destroyed, but at the present they say they can't locate it. They know they didn't destroy it or lock it up, but somewhere it's around. I just can't. It skipped my mind. And then there's the denial that evidence exists. In some way it appears later, but it'll appear in some form, but nobody has seen it. And one perfect example of denial of evidence was a letter sent over to the committee by Mr. Buzhardt. At the hearings, the White House waited till John Dean gave, you know, all of his testimony, and then they were really going to catch him. So the attorney for the president sends over a letter with the presidential seal and says, here's 30 good questions, let's get them, you know. So they read off all those questions, and John Dean answers them beautifully without making one flaw. And the White House said, we didn't send the list over. That is denial of evidence. You know, that's inoperative. You know, there's a lot of terminology of ways that espionage agents worked that has been taking place for a long time, but the public is getting such a dose of it now that it's almost unbelievable, and it should all be put into chapters of a book, which I will do someday. But the denial that they sent it in the first place, it's just a list with a White House seal, but the White House didn't send that over. That's the way they're working. Well, there are spy groups, and there's enemy lists, and then there's enemy lists inside of those lists. Because the Republicans in the White House had a list of enemies they were going to get. But they also had a list of Republican enemies, if you saw it in the paper this week. Those were the Republicans that they wouldn't have them for dinner, and they wouldn't support them, and they couldn't get passes to visit the White House. Jack Anderson has an article. And the only Republican enemy that wasn't there was Mr. Brooks, because he was black, and they didn't want to alienate him. They needed that showpiece, you know, for the Senate. So they weren't going to come down on him too hard. So he isn't on their enemy list. But all the others, there's a special list of Republican enemies that the Republicans keep. And they can't have tours of the White House. And this list is updated every 3 to 5 months. And they can't come to the White House for dinners or other functions. And they're denied presidential aides for certain trips. And this current list is kept up. But while we're slicing the Republican Party or the official party into little pieces, and this gets complicated, I've said before in the article I did in The Realist, that one on Martha Mitchell, and I've said it before on the radio show so many times, that the government is split into the Republican Party and the spy, the intelligence apparatus, which is visible now with the Watergate. Everyone can understand when I say that the committee to reelect the president had contact with the National Committee and Robert Dole, and they worked pretty hard. But that was a separate spy operation of sabotage, attack, dirty tricks, and it had its own office away from the standard Republicans who are conservatives or traditional conservatives. I use example in Greece, the traditional generals and the conservatives in Greece and the king and queen and those groups were sabotaged by a group of intelligence agencies and young people and young colonels that overthrew the government and kicked the conservatives out. Well, the committee to reelect the president had its own spy operation. But inside of that operation, the White House, it took aides from the White House that went from the White House to the committee to reelect the president. And they were going to have this martial law, this contingency plan, create violence at the conventions and down in Miami and blame the radicals. That's why they were working with internal security. They were going to round up the radicals, the people that protested Richard Nixon's policy in Vietnam and the war, and they would be locked up for good. And we would go on then with the war, which they're still threatening to do every day, as a matter of fact. So the idea was the martial law plan, and attached to the martial law plan was the plan to kill Richard Nixon. And this is something which I'm writing about now, and it's very fine line. It involves a man named Andrew Topping in New York, a Wall Street bond salesman, a college graduate, the upper echelon, an appointment to get into the White House. Now, Richard Nixon wouldn't have Haldeman and Ehrlichman and Mitchell and all of these men working hard for his reelection to the point of the Interintelligence Agency in the White House if they were going to kill him. And therefore, there has to be a separate group that work a branch apart, if you can follow it, from that other main body. And I think this week I hit upon it. I think as I read the paper closely, and it's delaying my writing, but I don't want to lose these threads, I've hit upon a possible clue. Because I said that in order to blame the radicals for, and the McGovern people, in the event they decide to kill Nixon, because everyone in the Watergate that's involved with the Watergate affair is far right wing. They are not Nixon people. The younger people around him are for Agnew, or they were for members from Young American for Freedom who support Ashbrook and Agnew. They feel the policy in China and Russia was wrong. They feel that Nixon is too far left. And I don't trust this Thomas Charles Houston who gives Richard Nixon orders. I think he comes out of Young American for Freedom and that splinter group. So you have the Republicans, and then you have your intelligence operation. Then in order to blame the Democrats for this operation, you have to have somebody inside the Democratic Party who is going to sabotage. And the man I suspect, I can't make charges, but I think they should investigate him, and I write an article that certainly links him as a question suspect, was Mr. Buchanan, Thomas Buchanan, in the White House, who spoke regularly and is a close friend of Mr. Oliver at the Democratic Party. At the Democratic offices, a Mr. Oliver had a phone that had a definite wiretap that connected to Mr. Alfred Baldwin over at the hotel, at the Howard Johnson Hotel. And the minute they wanted to see the conversations, they went over Mr. Oliver's phone, the Democrats, and said, no, you can't see those. It's illegal to produce in court. Wiretap conversation, you protect the right of the person whose conversation was overtaken. But in this case, I have reason to believe that this particular Mr. Oliver, it's been in the news, it's been documented that he's a very, very close friend of Buchanan, who writes the speeches and helps with Richard Nixon in the White House. And his telephone, Mr. Oliver's, was going over to Baldwin's from the Democratic offices. Well, this week it turned out that the Committee to Re-elect the President has a very secret bank account in Maryland. It's a private bank account in Maryland, and it's set up by Patrick Buchanan, the brother of the writer who writes for Richard Nixon. Henry Buchanan, he's an accountant, and his name is Henry Buchanan, and he had a special bank account. Now, what they said was he had an account that very few people could ever use, that Maurice Stantz had money coming into it, and his excuse for this account, the excuse coming into that account, was that a certain member of the Committee to Re-elect the President didn't think he was getting high enough salary, so they opened up a special account that only four or five people could use. But one of the men involved in this account is Kenneth Reitz. And that name comes in with the murder of William Mills, who they said was a suicide. That $25,000 siphoning through a Maryland bank that Mills said he never saw. And Wilbur Mills had two people working for him, a Colonel Webster and another man, his top campaign man and his second man, that were both murdered just in February, just before Mills commits suicide. So Mr. Kenneth Reitz is an agent provocateur who is hiring youth they were taking the Nixon side during the campus rides, getting ready for the convention. He was active in hiring radical provocateurs, Kenneth Reitz. His name comes in through the $25,000 that was siphoning through the Wilbur Mills account that Mills said he didn't know about. The secret bank is run by Henry Buchanan, who is the brother of the other Patrick Buchanan in the White House, who's in contact with Oliver. If you don't have a diagram or a chart, if you don't write these down, and I talk pretty fast, it may sound complicated, but these are the links. This secret $11,000 that went into this special bank from July 71 until the end of the year has to be watched, the location of the bank, the money pouring through Maryland, because you see, don't forget, Arthur Bramer's in a jail in Maryland, and that's where Wallace was shot in Maryland, and a lot of money poured into Maryland. And if this didn't have to do with violence in Miami, it could touch both areas. It could touch the Wallace affair, which is wide open for investigation, and it could touch future events that could take place in Miami that could even affect Richard Nixon's life. Because the same operatives like Mr. Charles Colson and Howard Hunt and Mr. Laswitz and Mr. Caulfield are appearing in the ITT affairs. They're up at Chappaquiddick involved with the Ted Kennedy affairs. They're out in Denver, Colorado with the Dita Beard. These operatives worked and they are involved with the Arthur Bramer case and going into Bramer's apartment, Howard Hunt, and being suggested by Colson immediately afterwards, get over to his apartment. He can say, I turned down the issue, because all the telephone records of these people have been subpoenaed, and people, the phone company and the lawyers, the investigators may say, well, why would Charles Colson call Howard Hunt an hour after George Wallace is shot, or an hour before maybe? How do we know? They have the time, they have the date, and they're tracing. That's how they found Donald Segretti, was the telephone calls that Howard Hunt was making from the White House and from his home to California. And Segretti is one of 50 agents. So you have a mess of agents working, but you have the same agents in all the operations. And because Louis Tackwood, the provocateur in Los Angeles, said that plans were to kill Richard Nixon, I have kept a separate file of all the evidence of where were these people in relation to Nixon in terms of weapons they had, or stockpile of weapons, or politically aligned to Nixon. And when I find that the Committee to Re-elect the President not only has a safe in Sloan's room or in Stan's room or the secretary, they had two safes with all this cash, they have to open their own bank account out in Maryland for just another tiny handful. It's out in Bethesda, Maryland. And there were funny little notes. There was one thing, Jeb Magruder was supposed to get money out there. One day, Buchanan told Jeb McGrew to go out there and get $24 in cash from the Bethesda bank account and then spend $5 and then send a messenger downtown with the rest. They were delivering messages right and left. These are the kind of little accounts that were going. They're an excuse for a delivery boy, but Jeb Magruder arranged the whole inauguration affair, the victory thing for Richard Nixon in Washington. He wanted to run for a high office in California. I'm sure that he's just running around to get, he's instructed to get $25 out of that Bethesda account, spend $5, and then go by messenger and deliver it somewhere else. These things are highly impossible, and I would say that they're excuses for delivering the withdrawals of this account. And then another thing, when Common Cause found out about this $11,000, or the General Accounting Office, that it was in this special bank in Bethesda, Maryland, under the name of Henry Buchanan, Buchanan called Marie Stans and said, what'll I do? There was an SOS call. He says, my God, what'll I do? Stans was down in Florida. And Stans says, well, just sit tight. The paper says Stans had a long-distance call to Buchanan in Florida in April and told him to bundle up his records, including those of the secret bank account, and deliver them to Stans' attorney. But instead, on April the 21st, the next day, Buchanan got a subpoena and had to turn them over to the federal district court. So that opened up this week, which is really a heavy case because while the hearings were not going on this week, so much was happening. And this is one of the very important links in my research. And while it may sound a little going around in circles or complicated to people who haven't heard the show often, those who follow Dialogue Conspiracy regularly, and I hope you do, I can see how my mind is working when I find these little separate accounts in Bethesda. And money is coming up. There's a lot of suits, you know, charges, indictments coming up with that $50,000 bogus Agnew dinner. And there's more to that than meets the eye. They had on the books $50,000 that wasn't raised. And, you know, then they said it was paid back to Washington. There's a lot more into that Maryland money. And we'll be following that as the time goes on. There's an article in the Chronicle today. I could do a whole show on this. I don't have time. It's on a probe into Illinois into the drug case. Charles Percy has ordered a probe into the investigation of the drug case. The DALE, Narcotics Division that was formed after, to be formed after the elections in 1972, is the basis of the American Gestapo. They took over the Bureau of Narcotics and made a separate group called DALE. And there's been a lot of exposure about this group. If I have time next week and there isn't too much news, I'll go into it. A Mr. Ambrose runs the group now. I think it's going to have to be taken apart. It's a Drug Abuse Law Enforcement. And I have a list from the New York Times of four people that have been killed by them and many, many others that have been terrorized. And it seems that we've taken over from Nazi Germany every tactic that they've used except one, that the breaking into homes, smashing things, terrorizing people, killing them, and leaving. And this seems to be one more step in the escalation of the domestic war against people in the United States. And the New York Times did a good service last week of carrying a long article about these people that have been killed, and it broke open an investigation into Illinois. The people are being chased out of town whose homes were broken into and they were held at gunpoint. And this will be the biggest service to this country if we break that open, because the Watergate group, it seems now, one of the men from DALE was on that sabotage plane that Sherman Skolnick spoke about, who was wearing a jumpsuit to get out. And he figures there's two members of this DALE that are involved in the Chicago airport thing at the time that Mrs. Hunt went down. It is a very dangerous group, identical to the Office of Management Budget that still exists, that Roy Ashe sits over and Fred Malik. Those two agencies were the nucleus of a Gestapo after the next election to control domestic harassment and control domestic budget. Now, the budget thing is an insidious breakdown where you deprive all the minorities of opportunities and youth programs and research programs and strangle them to the point where they have to go out in the streets. They have nowhere to go and commit violence or protest. And then the police come in and bring them in. The narcotics group, Mr. Liddy, G. Gordon Liddy, And in fact, Mrs. Dean now has a very mysterious background. I talked about her on another show. She came from Dallas, Texas, worked for the American Airlines, heavy into narcotic, working with the Narcotic Bureau and the Justice Department. The drug group and the Office of Management Budget have to be what were the strong arms of the Gestapo after the elections. We can all be very grateful that the Watergate occurred. We're far from cleaning out the Gestapo. My time is up. As usual, it goes pretty fast for me. I hope it does for you. But watch the things on Dale. Watch John Mitchell, the big daddy of the liars. If there's a top award, as a closing note, remember Jeb Magruder said, he told John Mitchell, the next time I go to the Senate, I'm going to tell the truth. I perjured myself last time. And Mitchell said, that's very commendable, but I'm going to have to take the other course. So with that in mind, remember what you hear tomorrow is only tongue-in-cheek, and maybe you'll get a few more perjury charges. Okay, that's it. I'll see you next week.
You've been listening to Dialogue Conspiracy featuring research specialist Mae Bressel. Appears to be